the space to build, the sunlight to power affordable, reliable, renewable energy.
Cooperation over chaos. We are all in this together.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We're broadcasting from stolen land, land that was never ceded, always was and always will be First Nations land. As we face up to the climate crisis, we could do well to take note of the incredible accumulation of ancient wisdom that has come from putting their country and their communities as central in all their decision making. And that lifestyle, that existence is going to be what we need as we face up to the climate crisis, which is strengthening by the day.
The year the climate bill arrived. After more than a decade of talk about it, it seems like this is the year. With national emergencies and heat lockdowns and 2 million people in China evacuated from flooding and everything we can see happening around the world. I mean, I can just look out of the window. My backyard, the plants and flowers out there are confused. They seem to think it's spring already. And I know that the farmers and the winemakers can see it on their fields. The world is warming. And the bill for all our climate pollution is arriving. Crops failure. This heat wave in Europe has cut an estimated 10 million tons from European grain forecasts. That's the same as a loss of 2 billion euros. The same as 3.2 billion Australian dollars. In the United Kingdom alone, just 1 week of heatwave meant 24 million working hours were lost because of extreme heat. These economic losses, that's the climate bill. And at the same time, because of what I would call the Trump effect, over the past year, 45 different governments have made decisions to delay action on climate, to weaken their regulations, to abandon the targets that they have, and to give fossil fuel industries even more room to expand. At exactly the time when you would think the climate crisis is becoming impossible to ignore, we have these politicians now. They can look out their windows, outside their parliament buildings, and see the effects that the heat has on their societies, the fires and the floods and the losses. And yet, they choose to step backwards. And the media is looking the other way too. According to the Media and Climate Change Observatory, global news coverage of climate change in the first 5 months of this year was 35% lower than the same period last year. So we have a crisis that's going more and more dangerous. We have politicians who are going the wrong way, making our laws weaker. And we have the media talking about it less. And the problem is also the quality of their reporting, because when there's a heat wave or wildfires or floods, these news organizations, they report it as isolated, in quotation mark, natural disasters. So on the TV screens, we see a burning home here and an exhausted firefighter there, and then they move on to the next story. They continue to fail to explain the connection there is, the scientific connection there is between these disasters we're seeing and our burning of coal, oil and gas. And, I mean, some media outlets amplify Trump's story that the climate science is a hoax. But the reality is that all these things are connected. We are living through an accelerating climate emergency. That is the real story. Our governments refuse to lead. and corporations continue to profit from the destruction, and media fails to connect the dots. So who will tell the truth about what's happening? Well, welcome to the Sustainable Hour. That's what we do. We like to begin with a global outlook, which is provided by our faithful globalized journalist, Colin Market, OAM. And Colin, I have a feeling that it's not good news you have for us today, especially not from Europe.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Mick. And it is in Europe where I'll begin this week, where wildfires have swept through parts of France, Spain and Italy, forcing thousands of people to escape blazes that are fanned by scorching temperatures and strong winds. Three firefighters died last week in southern Europe, and the whole of southern Europe is enduring another spell of severe heat, with temperatures topping 40 degrees in several areas. The total area of land that has burned this year in European Union countries is the second largest on record, and we're only in July. Now, that's according to satellite data from the European Forest Fire Information Service. In Sicily last week, around 600 firefighters, forest guards and civil protection officers were fighting dozens of fires, many of which are still raging. One firefighter died after falling ill while battling the flames, the interior minister said. A spokesperson for Italy's civil protection agency said the fires were being fueled by very high temperatures and very dry soil. They also said that many of them had been deliberately lit. More than 160 fires have also been recorded in the Calabria region of Italy, with a local civil population chief saying several were deliberately lit there too. In Spain, a national emergency was declared as several wildfires burned out of control, forcing the evacuation of 10,000 people in the Madrid region and nearby Avila. The largest fires are very close to the capital, and they prompted the Spanish Prime Minister to call for a new combined international action on climate change. He called for everybody to say, this is serious, it's a war, we should all join together and fight it. Spain has seen 32,000 hectares burned since last Thursday. Back in France, around Bordeaux, more than 20,000 people, mostly tourists and campsites and holiday people, were evacuated last Wednesday as fire ravaged a seaside pine forest. We're dealing with a very dense stand of closely packed pines, the firefighter captain, Wilfried Schneider, said, describing the fire as of rare intensity. European droughts and wildfires are both now more severe due to the burning of fossil fuels, according to climatologists from the World Weather Attribution, which warned that another heatwave fire event is imminent in Europe, possibly as close as later this week. Now, back home, soaring electric vehicle uptake is materially reducing Australia's petrol demand, as watchers forecast the ongoing global oil crisis could put enough clean cars on the road to leave Australian drivers much less exposed to future fuel shortages. Now, that's good for the climate, but it has both motoring organisations and energy experts warning that Australia now needs to accelerate its program of charging rollouts. They're warning about a fact that we all know, that EV charging stations are tucked away in urban shopping centres when they really should be in service stations on major highways. But almost all of those service stations are directly or indirectly owned by fossil fuel multinational corporations, who are unlikely to cooperate in a push that would reduce their sales. That's what would happen if they put in EV chargers rather than selling petrol. Now, that's a problem for the federal government, which has proved in the past that it is unwilling to break its current hand-in-glove relationship with the fossil fuel industry. So we're in for some interesting times ahead, especially as the problem becomes more acute with ever more EVs being sold. And at present, that's every fourth vehicle in the market. The sale of EVs in Australia exceeded the milestone of 100,000 a year, new vehicle sales last year in 2025. And Electric Vehicle Council Chief Executive Julie Dallavicchio said that this figure has already been overtaken in the first 6 months of this year. So we've doubled what we were selling last year. Meanwhile, the world figures released last week show that the top 10 countries with the fastest EV growth in June of this year. And Australia wasn't even in the running, despite those accelerated sales figures. Top of the list was Laos, with EVs comprising 100% of all new passenger vehicles sold. Second was Slovenia, with sales of passenger EVs up 124.7% year on year. Then comes China because of its uptake of heavy-duty electric trucks. They were up 104% year on year. Fourth came Italy, where passenger vehicles are up 97.9% year on year. And then France, up 91.7%. Ireland was next, up 88%. Germany then came afterwards at 78.2%. And Denmark was up 63.2% year on year. But that was on a previous high. And then there's a couple of surprise nations. In India came in at ninth place by virtue of its sales of electric three-wheeler vehicles, up 42% year on year. And in 10th place was Kenya, with its electric two-wheelers up by 38.5% year on year. That's electric two-wheelers against petrol-driven two-wheelers, I should say there. Now, every one of those nations is contributing to the decline of CO2 emissions into our atmosphere and challenging the power of the fossil fuel industry. And that small piece of good news ends my roundup for the week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our guest today is Rhys Forsyth. Rhys is the founder and managing director of a group called Code Nation. He's an experienced leader working at the intersection of politics, social change, and technology. So, Rhys, welcome to the Sustainable Hour. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
A pleasure. Now, tell us about your group first, the Code Nation. What's the origin of that name? And yeah, let's get to know you a bit.
Yeah, for sure. So I should say, first of all, I've been with Code Nation for 8 years now, but I didn't actually start the company. That was one of my business partners, Corey McCann, along with another partner at the time, Alex, who is still working in the climate movement in the fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. I believe you spoke to one of his colleagues, Michael Poland, a few weeks back.
Yes.
So they started the company, it was about 2013 or 2014, working from Colombia at the time. And they had some background in politics and helping with campaigns and campaign strategy, but quickly discovered there was a real need for people with technical expertise to help support those campaigns, working with the climate movement and with climate forward political candidates. So basically, Corey became a self-taught coder and developer, helping create websites and provide database support for climate campaigns. So that was, 12, 13 years ago now. The company has grown and built on that foundation. Corey is still very much actively involved as one of the fellow directors in the company, and over time added kind of new staff members, new partners to the business. We now work across websites, database support, automations, expert coaching and capacity building for people using those technical systems, as well as creating some of our own products to help with community organizing We've got a platform called Supporterbase, which helps with empowering local volunteer leaders to run campaigns in their own communities. And we also help with things like kind of analytics, metrics, helping organizations track their digital KPIs. We're very much focused on progressive politics and campaigns in Australia and internationally. And within that, we've worked primarily in the climate and conservation movement. So working with groups like the Australian Conservation Foundation, other conservation bodies, with big mobilizations like Stop Adani, but then also with political candidates and groups which want to see greater action on climate change. So the independent movement most recently.
That's a wide spectrum, Rhys. Have you had any notable successes?
Yeah, there have been a few successes. Unfortunately, not every campaign ends in success, but I think the independent movement has been a good example of the success that you can have with community-driven politics. We've all seen that in recent years, quite a number of independents getting elected in 2022. We worked with about five or six of the independents, including Senator Pocock and others that were elected into Parliament, to put greater pressure on our major political parties to take a greater level of ambition when it comes to climate change. So I'd see that as quite a big success, being able to support those candidates in 2020, as early as 2019, actually, some of the early independent candidates, then 2022, 2025 again, a number of those MPs being re-elected, and some of them on much stronger margins. But then we also see a lot of success at the grassroots level as well. We've worked on campaigns like Give a Damn up in New South Wales, with Wilderness Australia at the time opposing the raising of the Warragamba Dam wall, which was going to have really negative impacts on a lot of the local ecosystem through flooding, as well as some quite important First Nations cultural sites. And through working with campaigns like that to really be able to petition government to help them mobilise their supporters and support the excellent campaigners that we work with, be able, eventually that dam was not raised in 2023. The New South Wales government abandoned those plans. We see grassroots campaigns like that across the country having good success, not all the time, unfortunately, depending on the government of the day and the political climate that we're in. But I think there are a lot of those unsung successes that do happen day in, day out.
I understand that you're in Vanuatu at the moment. Is that climate related?
It's not actually. It's my wife. My wife is posted here. She works for the Department of Foreign Affairs. So we've been moving almost constantly for the last 10 to 12 years. But, you know, Vanuatu is very climate aware, climate forward. The climate change minister here is very active and very capable. Of course, being one of the key drivers of the recent decisions of the ICJ on the responsibility that states have to limit the damage from fossil fuels. So yeah, it's quite interesting being here, being in the Pacific and seeing both the frontline impacts. Vanuatu's unfortunately prone to a lot of natural disasters, which are only getting worse with climate change. So it's an interesting time to be here in the Pacific, but I can't say it's through my own work that I'm here.
You're seeing things firsthand. We're in Victoria, which is in the run-up to an election at the moment. Is your group in any way campaigning in the upcoming Victorian election?
Yeah, so we'll be supporting a number of candidates and parties that are, on the progressive end of the spectrum, you might say, who are very, very focused on climate action. We'll support them through things like website support, database support. There are a number of organisations that are apolitical but are not-for-profits that campaign to try and hold politicians to account on their climate commitments. So groups like Environment Victoria, I believe you've spoken to recently as well, we use some of our software like Supporterbase to help mobilise their local groups and allow their volunteer leaders to really make their presence felt, whether that's through things like rostering, so getting volunteers to stand at booths and hand out the how to vote cards, whether it's distributing campaign material like posters or lobbying their local candidates. So we have a role, I guess, not just in the political end, but also bipartisan, not-for-profit community as well, that just want to see stronger commitments on climate.
Rhys, could you take us through the situation where a client contacts you? What's the process from there in getting you to do the work that they commission?
Yeah, absolutely. So we often get people reach out either via our website or just through referrals. Australia's a pretty small place at the end of the day, and a pretty small community in the campaign world. So we get repeat clients who kind of know us and know what we do, and will come back to work with us as they move from campaign to campaign, or they might refer others that have worked with us. Usually we start with a quick scoping or discovery call with myself or other members of the team to really understand their needs, what they're trying to achieve. And then from there, decide whether we're in a good position to help. If we're not, we'll very happily provide free advice around how they might go about achieving their objectives, whether or not that involves working with us. And if there is a good fit, if there's something that we think we can really help with, then we'll outline the services, how we go about it, what the costs are going to be, the most cost-efficient way of doing it, which is, of course, very important when you're working in the not-for-profit space as well. And I should say I'm only one of a team of seven at the moment. I'm the least technical of the team. So I help with kind of running the business and some of the initial discovery and things like that. We've got a really wonderful team of technologists who work across website development, full stack development, design, and we make sure we always try and bring those people in to help kind of bring their expertise to bear in solving those problems.
Is AI empowering you?
It is. Yeah, it's an interesting and fraught topic, and it'd be interested to get your perspectives on this as well, because on the one hand, AI can be really problematic in a lot of ways, whether it's on copyright and security, privacy, things like that, as well as the demand for new power generation, and we're seeing that debate at the moment with AI and data centers, and of course we'd want to see that if there's new energy demand, that's being met entirely by renewables. But I think on the flip side of that is it does have a lot of potential for the campaign movement that we work with and for our clients and for ourselves. I guess an example, if we're doing complex database analysis or creating new tools and new campaigns, might have taken days previously and not an insignificant budget for organizations to manage. But that important work can now be done in a fraction of the time and a fraction of the cost, which saves on their precious resources, saves their donors' resources, which are very important to protect, and it means we can be more responsive when it comes to campaigns as well, because often we are working to some pretty tight timelines. There'll be a key political moment, somebody will want to launch a campaign the next day or several days later. They need live petitions, they need a new website, they might be sending out kind of targeted emails to all of their supporters. They want to maintain a pretty responsive kind of posture, so AIs can be really useful for that, but of course you need to have those controls in place as well, I guess, at a societal level around the energy use that's tied up in that, the kind of copyright protections for creatives, and at the same time at an individual level, making sure you've still got humans with oversight of everything that happens and goes out, and you take ultimate responsibility for anything that you produce. You're not using it in a way which is reckless in terms of ingesting data into those systems. So yeah, there's really great opportunities, I think, for campaigns and technologists, but as with any new technology, a lot of risks to think about as well.
No, a completely different subject, Rhys. I'm aware that the current motivation for people buying up electric cars in Australia is very much centered in the Middle East conflict and the shortage and the instability of the oil situation. It's a strange, strange thing that's happened, that the fossil fuel industry is destroying its own business with this instability. You're clearly across all of the different factors. Can you see this being really, really good for the world, that eventually future historians will look back upon the United States-Iran war as the catalyst for the world finally waking up and getting off of oil?
Well, I hope so. I think I should say at the outset, I'm not an expert in kind of energy markets or some of these areas. But just as an observer, and I do follow a lot of people that are, people that you've spoken to in your podcast, and others in the space, and we're lucky to work with a lot of really great thinkers, think tanks, not-for-profits, so I'll definitely defer to them in terms of the expertise, but in reading a lot of their analysis and kind of thinking myself, I think it's just becoming increasingly clear to a lot of people that This is not an just an environmental issue. It's not just a climate issue. It's an economic issue. It has to do with national sovereignty, with national security, and our dependence on fossil fuels is not just terrible for the planet, but it's terrible for our own kind of economic well-being, our stability as a country, our society. And I think this shock has helped awaken people perhaps from that complacency a little bit, just seeing how fragile some of the supply chains are when we're relying on these fossil fuels. So hopefully people remember that, and is a bit of a catalyst for people to continue to electrify and reduce their dependence on these fossil fuels. And I think that is kind of broadly accepted and seen across large sections of the political community as well.
Rhys, what is it that excites you the most about what you guys are doing, what Code Nation is doing?
I get really excited, not just in the day-to-day in supporting campaigns. It's great when you support a campaign and have a big win or get a lot of prominence. So, for example, we're seeing Environs Kimberley at the moment in Western Australia really standing up to fracking in those areas and getting some record numbers of submissions. Those things are definitely really memorable, and they definitely excite and drive the team who are kind of day-to-day, potentially in the code or the design. I think seeing those impacts and those wins in the real world are really motivating. But I think over a longer time horizon, I get really excited about the ability to try and create some systems and tools which can sustain the movement over time. We are a small Australian company, so we don't have kind of external capital or investors or some of the resources that a big software company might. And that poses challenges in terms of how well we're able to service the broad section of clients, right from the really big not-for-profits that have the budget for really detailed support, but also the smaller grassroots organizations who can have a really big impact, but maybe don't have the resources available immediately. And what excites me is being able to try and work on systems which are more sustainable for all of our clients, regardless of their budget. So examples might be initially working with groups like ACF and others to create great new platforms which they can use for their communities, but then turning that into a model where we can reuse those systems or those subscription products or those techniques for smaller grassroots organizations to have access to as well. I think that's kind of, it's something we're always working on and we haven't perfected yet. It's a kind of an ongoing process, but I'm excited about the ability to try and be able to do all of those things while sustaining a business that pays our staff fairly and rewards their expertise.
Something big coming up in the horizon is the next UN climate summit, which usually takes place, is it in the end of November? Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if the whole climate movement has, a cycle, an annual cycle where it builds up, the reports begin to come out in October. You feel the tension, and this is globally, as a build up towards this COP, as it's called, Conference of Nations, which this year is going to be with Australia leading the negotiations. So do you feel, the preparations are already beginning among your clients and so on for this big moment?
Yeah, I think a lot of our clients definitely grasp the opportunity that's there, with Australia playing a key role as a point of leverage that hopefully our clients can capitalize on to kind of spotlight what Australia is doing, what it isn't doing, where it could be doing better, and then using its role to ideally play a leadership position. I think Australian governments have made progress in kind of recent years compared to maybe say 10 years ago. I was at the time working for DFAT and having to sell Australia's climate policy around the time of the Paris Agreement, which is a whole other story, but one of the reasons I've kind of ended up on the path I'm on. So, I think we've made progress since then, but there's definitely more we could be doing. It's a good opportunity to for our clients and for the community more broadly to be able to push the current government to the highest level of ambition that is required, and then use that leadership position to try and bring other countries along as well. Because as a middle power, I think Australia does have a reasonable amount of influence that we shouldn't underestimate, that we can and should use.
But it's as if the government at the moment is speaking with two tongues. Because on one hand, Australians and the Australian government is quite proud of, for instance, how 4 million houses now have solar on the roof and we are taking action and so on. This is domestically. But at the same time, 80% of the fossil fuels we dig out of the ground is exported.
Mm-hmm.
And on that side, the government is subsidizing the companies and it's allowing companies to increase that production. So what's going on there and what's your analysis of this situation?
Look, I think that's a good reason why we need a strong crossbench and a strong civil society movement to hold the government to account on those exact points that you mentioned. We can give some credit where there's progress on electrification while still really not forgetting those components and campaigning strongly on that. So you saw a big campaign that we helped support some of our clients with around the gas tax and ensuring fair taxation of Australian resources. And also a number of our clients campaigning against gas expansion because the government has been giving the green light to kind of new gas expansion of gas projects, which is entirely inconsistent with what we need to be doing given the state of the climate. So I think it just highlights the importance of those civil society independent groups to hold people to account. I can at a and as much as I entirely agree with that, I think the government needs to do more. I can see that the government is potentially gun-shy, a bit wary of the political backlash if they're seen by some in the community to move too quickly against some of the fossil fuel sector and some of our resources sector. So we're probably treading slowly, and I'd be hopeful that maybe they'd reconsider a gas tax kind of in the lead up to the next budget, or stronger action in the lead up to the next budget where perhaps they feel like they've got maybe some more political cover and it's not right around the same time as the Iran crisis and negotiations with nation states around supply of those fuels. I think maybe they felt like the time was a little bit fraught for that. I would like to hope that the optimistic side of me hopes that they'll continue to make some progress, but I think that's all the more reason for everyone to still be able to hold them to account and point out where decisions are inconsistent and where, as you say, they are maybe speaking with one tongue to one group and then singing a different tune to another.
Mm. I'm noticing you're smiling a lot. You seem very content with your job and the work you're doing. We talk with a lot of people who feel very anxious and I would say close to despair about the situation, the way things are moving with the climate, as slow as it's going. What gets you up in the morning in terms of keeping that positivity that you have?
I think my kids wake me up in the morning. They're the thing that get me up at 6 a.m. I'm smiling also because I'm enjoying, really enjoy the conversation. Thanks again for having me on. It's great to chat with you all. I think, it's just because there's no other option, right? I'm not saying that despair is irrational. I mean, given the state of the climate and the direction we're heading in a number of areas of society, I can totally understand that despair. It's when you look at the figures and the facts alone, maybe that's the rational response. But I think, it's not helpful. At the end of the day, you need to get up and do something about it. We might not be able to avoid all the worst impacts of climate change and some other things that are going on, but that doesn't stop us from working as hard as we can to minimize the impacts and to improve things where we can. I think as a society, kind of not just Australia but globally, we face lots of different challenges in the past, and I think there are opportunities to get better and to make improvements, and we have a lot of very bright people working on these issues. Whether it's in the campaign space that we're in, or whether it's kind of people in the scientific space making new discoveries and helping with adaptation resilience, how to suck more carbon out of the atmosphere. We've got great researchers and we've got, a new wave of politicians who are maybe increasingly more passionate about this issue. So I think there are some reasons for positivity, but also the main one is just that I think there's no other alternative than to get up and just do things.
Carbon feeds the sea, evaporation feeds the clouds. The ocean spins slower but hotter and acidified. One month of rain in a single surge, drowning our city streets submerged. Red alert in the engine room, mass evacuation emergency. Prepare for impact.
We need to move beyond good intentions.
Prepare for impact.
purposeful action.
Overseeing says scientists has never been seen before. This is the age of the transapocalyptic medical act.
There is a point to that.
It doesn't look like the movies we saw. It's rising prices, inequality war. Industry holding our future at ransom. Leaders say nothing's wrong. Prepare for impact.
It is important to have these good intentions, but it's the actual purposeful actions that matter.
Prepare for impact.
To purposeful action.
But collapse is not the end. It's the turning of the page. The moment we start choosing a direction and a vision. The future's not given, it's ours to create. The dangers in clinging to comfort and fate. Our task is not to rescue, we nurture the new. We imagine, we build and regenerate.
We do need to address this issue, it's critical and urgent.
Prepare for impact.
We need to move beyond good intentions.
Prepare for impact.
To purposeful action.
Every choice we make cuts a little carbon, heals a little wound, restores a little faith. Oh yes, we live on the edge, but we give birth to the new. More gratitude, more time, more laughter, more hope. Prepare for impact.
We recently celebrated 600 editions of the Sustainable Hour, Reece, and I can recall going back to the earlier editions, our hopes were very much tied to science. We were always hopeful that the message that was coming from the scientific community was going to change things in the standard community. They didn't. That's why 600 editions later. I'm quite hopeful because of this current American president and this current war. And I'll give you my reasons. Number one, you've heard already my belief that it's the instability of the petrol market that is causing Australians to shift to electric vehicles. Another thing that's come out of this current war is that Iran, which has always been a rogue nation, Iran now understands that the way that it can control Donald Trump and America is by reducing the amount of oil that goes along the Hormuz Strait. And given that scenario, almost certainly we're going to have oil shortages and oil differences in the ongoing future. So suddenly a world that was dependent on oil is now having no option but to move into sustainable options. And the third thing, this is just completely by the by, one of the things that's come out of this conflict and the one in the Ukraine is that if you want to host a war in the 21st century, you don't use submarines, you use drones. Cheap drones. Couple of $1,000 and you can take out an aircraft carrier. So with a bit of luck, it'll get us out of AUKUS as well. Because sooner or later, the penny's going to drop in Canberra that billions and billions of dollars on the promise of a submarine in 20 years' time is not good deals. That's why I'm saying that right now the political war situation is better for Australia and for the climate movement than all of the talking that we've done in the past. Now, that wasn't a question at all. That was merely me ranting off, and I would like your thoughts on the same streams, if I can.
Yeah, I mean, on the war, I think Donald Trump has definitely overplayed his hand and not really knowing what he's got himself into there. And I think you're right, it could have a bit of a role in shocking a lot of us out of our complacency. I think it's also tied potentially to a broader challenge and maybe now opportunity the climate movement has had. As you said, we all wanted science and kind of a rational fear of being wiped off the planet to be a good motivator for people to make change, or for governments of the day to make change. And that just really hasn't worked. Those arguments haven't stood up, at least they haven't stood up as soon as other challenges arose. So even if climate was at the top of people's minds for a while, as soon as the economy were in bad shape, it would drop back down the list of biggest concerns, and it's just not really winning people elections, the pure environmental argument. Now, of course, you can discuss whether that's good or not, but I think it's just a fact. And I think we're seeing now, though, moving to a new phase where it's not just about the environment, it's not just about a livable planet, it's about the economy. And people are very clearly seeing that the impacts in their power bills. They put rooftop solar and a battery in their home and realize their power bills are going down. They've got an electric vehicle and they're not hostage to the same energy shocks that everyone else is. And I think just the economics of it at scale with everyday people and their everyday lives feeling both the negatives of fossil fuels as well as the positives of making a change toward electrification or removing themselves from that system, I think is ultimately what gives me a bit of hope in that there may be a tipping point for a broader section of society, not just the section which may be very, very passionate and very, very environmentally conscious, but a much broader, swing group of Australians who have seen the day-to-day practical impacts for their lives, not to mention the real-life kind of physical impacts that they're seeing from climate change as well.
Currently you're in Vanuatu, and it's very much in our eyes, I guess, is climate central in terms of its exposure to extreme weather events. Can you, I guess this is a change of direction, but your experience of being there, what have you seen of that?
Yeah, so I should say we've been fortunate not to have been here during some of the major disasters. We arrived a few weeks after the horrible earthquake that poor people of Vanuatu suffered through about 18 months ago. And then before that, some major cyclones, which just decimated a lot of the infrastructure on the island. But we haven't seen the worst impacts. But speaking to people here that have been through that, that's obviously pretty devastating. You know, entire towns, villages, the housing and a lot of infrastructure wiped out. And it takes years to recover. I guess that is one thing we do see is the recovery. It doesn't happen overnight. Even if those cyclones were years ago, it's kind of years to kind of rebuild a lot of the say the sanitation or electricity or other infrastructure. And for developing countries, that takes that's a big drain on your resources. It requires coordination between kind of aid partners and other development partners and local governments and local communities. And you see people rebuilding. It takes several years to get to a decent place again. And then, of course, the problem with climate change is those disasters are only going to get more and more frequent. So your time available to recover, to try and get the community into a good place again, only gets shorter and shorter. And that is obviously going to be heartbreaking and very, very difficult. As resilient as the people are here, because they are very resilient countries, they've had to be with one of the highest rates of natural disasters. I think communities can only take so much, and I think that's something that's going to be a challenge going forward. Again, not being an expert in the Pacific, but it is just something that you see in the day-to-day.
That's how much climate activism and climate coding we could put into one sustainable hour. Thank you very much to Riz. And before you leave us, Riz, just give us a tip. If people want to get in touch with you, where do they find you and what can they do? How does it work? Secondly, we'd like to hear from you. What should we be? We always have been saying be the change, be the difference as an ending of our program. What's your be?
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. I'll have to let one part of my brain think about that while I start with the easier part. Yeah, thanks a lot to all of you for having me on and for inviting me on. It was, yeah, lots of great fun. My wife always tells me I've got a monotone, so hopefully it wasn't too monotonous. But yeah, really, really appreciate it. Had a great chat and happy to come on any time that is useful to you. Maybe in the lead up to some coming elections, we can talk about what's going on there at some point. Congratulations again on over 600 episodes. That's quite a milestone. Really amazing work. I think maybe it's not as exciting as and inspiring as you might like, or as some other bigger slogans of some bigger thinkers, but I think just to be there, just keep turning up. It's one thing to have one moment of inspiring action, but I think you've just got to just be there, keep turning up day after day, making incremental progress. And I think across many people, organizations, governments, that will make the difference in the end. So that's my suggestion.
Love it. But before that, just remember, how do people get in touch with you?
Oh, yeah. That was the easy part. CodeNation.com. So, yeah, if you just look at CodeNation.com or CodeNation Australia, there are a couple of CodeNations around the world. There's one in the US and one in India. Some people get mixed up. But CodeNation Australia, we've got contact forms on the website. They can book a call with me as well via the website there. I have a little Calendly link. I'm always happy to have a chat, even if it's not for a direct project. If people just want free advice, if they're a grassroots organization, small not-for-profit, they want to talk about their digital presence, their website, how they do their community organizing with tech, happy to have a quick chat about how all that works.
Good.
Thanks.
Thanks, Reese. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
Isn't being impacted. There's nobody on earth whose career isn't being altered, whose family's prospects aren't being changed, whose community isn't being threatened.
This is where the head meets the heart and moves the hands, where stories grow like roots and joy is the fuel. I don't ask what will I sacrifice, I simply ask what brings me alive. Regeneration is our compass, care is our culture, deep democracy is relationship. We are not separate from nature, we are nature remembering itself. Climate community, that is the vision, that is the call. Measure not in GDP, but in GDN, gross domestic nurture. We're done with offsetting. What we onset is community.
We tell stories that make us laugh. We choose meaning over consumption. We practice being the kind of humans the earth can trust again. We are already here, and we welcome you in our climate community.
Once you've centered the reality of planetary crisis in your decision making, you realize that the tempo, your idea of tempo of change, what is possible in what sort of period of time, completely changes.
We need new ways of communicating global sustainability. We are fundamentally undermining the stability, the resilience, and life support on Earth. This is what science shows. 7 of 9 planetary boundaries have now been breached. And not only do we therefore need new ways of communicating sustainability, but also more communication of sustainability. We need to shift towards emphasizing that this is about resilience, it's about human health, it's about security, it's about prosperity and equity for all of humanity. Whatever happens locally will propel itself and have impacts globally. What happens somewhere else on planet Earth sends invoices back across the entire planet. We're totally intertwined and putting pressure on the entire planet. Inspired by this science and the Planetary Boundary Framework, a new group of researchers, communicators, have, you know, over 100 in one community effort come together to co-create a science-based communications handbook, the Planetary Communications. The objective of this work is to support and connect people worldwide who want to communicate the latest sustainability science as effectively as possible, helping to secure life, security, prosperity, and equity within the safe operating space of planetary boundaries. This means crafting new narratives that resonate across cultures, designing visuals that make complexity accessible and understandable, and developing communication strategies that inspire collective action, all of it being scientifically grounded. This requires major investments in communication development, time, human resources, expertise, but not only creating new narratives, but also developing this in line with the exponential development in the digital AI-driven communication highways. This is all communication for resilience, for stability. It is sustainability communication that can enable and support better decision support, supporting social and economic development to build more stable societies in line with the turbulent world we're living in, to have a manageable planet for all future generations.
Anger and bewilderment are growing as more and more Americans cope with gasoline lines and empty pumps.
And I'm out of gas, dead out.
I'm in a line 2 hours in, I can't get gas. This is baloney.
Why doesn't anybody contact the president? Why is he letting this happen to us?
Some of the people online here still don't have a tank of gas.
Except for this gentleman who's driving an electric vehicle.
Nah, I'm fine. I charged at home last night. Good luck though.